Hello, it is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and you are listening to The Corridor, bringing you local and regional news from Kingston and the surrounding area, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christine Delory, covering the first ever Cassie and Friends Kingston Run for Juvenile Arthritis Awareness.
Hello, I'm Christine Delory, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. For most toddlers, learning to walk is one of the first big milestones. But for Cassie Port, that milestone suddenly disappeared. At just 20 months old, she woke up one morning unable to walk, a moment that would lead to a diagnosis that would shape the rest of her life. Cassie was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, a chronic autoimmune disease that causes joint inflammation, pain, fatigue, and without proper treatment, long-term damage in children. But what began as a frightening diagnosis eventually grew into something much bigger. The Cassie and Friends Run, a national charity helping families across Canada. I sat down with Cassie, now a third-year health sciences student at Queen's University, to talk about how it all began.
So my name's Cassie, and when I was 20 months old, I woke up and I just wouldn't walk. So I had been walking like the night before, and I just wouldn't walk that morning. And my knee was the size of a baseball. So my parents quickly rushed me to the hospital, where eventually I was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis. So that's a bit different than like rheumatoid arthritis, which is found in older people. So I was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or JIA. And my parents were searching and searching for support where they could meet other families with children with arthritis and stuff like that. But all they could find was arthritis support for older people. So my dad decided to sign up for the Scotiabank 5K run and raise a bit of money for research and stuff like that. And he sent it to some of his colleagues and his friends, and practically overnight raised close to $18,000, which was very exciting. And we went to the run. We cheered on my dad. He ran the 5K. And that day, under the rainy tent, pretty much Cassie and Friends and the idea of it was born. And my parents wanted to be able to support other families like me and that had children like me or siblings like me, so other parents could meet each other, so other children could meet each other, and to raise money for research for juvenile arthritis.
Nearly two decades later, Cassie and Friends is Canada's only national charity dedicated to children and youth living with juvenile arthritis and other childhood onset rheumatic diseases. Cassie grew up attending events organized through the charity, meeting other kids facing the same challenges she did.
Cassie and Friends has always been a great support system for me. We've had events like other runs every single year. I'm from Vancouver, so I would go to the ones in Vancouver. We also had something called Family Day, which is a whole day with activities for the kids and conferences for the parents. So parents will listen to speakers that give them different tips or new research to support their children with arthritis, while the kids would do fun activities for different age groups and get to meet each other and make lots of friends. And, you know, like when I would go to school, no one would have arthritis or do injections once a week like me. So when I could meet other kids that were going through the same thing, it was very nice to have that support. And I've definitely been able to maintain a lot of those friendships.
That experience also helped shape Cassie's career ambitions and ultimately led her to Queen's.
Because I was so in the medical, like I guess in the medical world and like immersed in it from such a young age and going to all these doctor's appointments, that led me to become very interested in science. And just like anyone else, I was interested in science. I applied to Queen's Health Sciences and got in, which was very exciting. And I always knew I wanted to do something in medicine because I was so immersed in that world growing up. And as I started learning a bit more and studying, I became interested in pediatric rheumatology, which is the exact kind of doctor that I went to. And I just feel like I would have such a unique perspective for these other kids like me. And pretty much, I just want to be able to help other kids like me. And that's what's led me down the path of medicine and specifically to pediatric rheumatology.
Now studying at Queens, Cassie is helping bring that support network to Kingston. On March 7th, Kingston will host the first ever Team Cassie and Friends run at City Park. The event is organized with the support of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club, which brings together students living with arthritis and other rheumatic conditions.
I have to give credit, actually, to one of the old presidents of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club. She started the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club when she got diagnosed. And the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club brings together Queens students with arthritis and other rheumatic diseases. We make care packages to send to other students with rheumatic diseases that have ice packs and heating pads and injection support and stuff like that, as well as having different events to bring people together. So similar to what Cassie and Friends does to meet other students with the same disease. And we decided to collaborate with Cassie and Friends and host one of these runs because a lot of different communities, like in Hamilton, they do them, in London, there's a lot of different community runs. And we thought, well, we have this club here, so why don't we have a run in Kingston? And that's how it came to be.
In addition to raising funds, the run is also about building community, something that can be difficult in smaller cities like Kingston.
I think that this really raises awareness that there can be rheumatic diseases in students. And the transition to any university is tough, like learning how to live alone and having so much more independence, cook your own meals, all that stuff. You have to adjust to that no matter what. And then when you have a rheumatic disease, there's added things to adjust to. Like, I had to learn how to do my injections on my own before my mom had been doing them. Or it's so much colder here than back in Vancouver, and that definitely affects my joints as well. So there's just so many other aspects that you have to think about. And this run and Queens Rheumatic Disease Club in itself can bring all these Queens students together that have rheumatic diseases. And then for the Kingston community, since Kingston, there's no children's hospital here, and I'm pretty sure the closest ones would be like SickKids or in Ottawa. So a lot of these families that have children with rheumatic diseases, they have to travel really far to get their specific treatment. By hosting this run in Kingston, these families are able to meet other families in their community. And it's the same thing that Family Day does or these runs do in other places, is it allows them to meet other families in the Kingston community, especially when there's so few compared to those bigger cities.
Raising awareness is another major goal. According to recent polling, only about 1 in 5 Canadians know that arthritis can affect children. And yet, early diagnosis is critical, as delays can lead to joint damage, chronic pain, and long-term damage. Funds raised through Cassie and Friends support research, family support programs, and improved treatments.
So right now, the main focus of Cassie and Friends is looking for a cure. So a lot of research focus on a cure for juvenile arthritis. But there's also the treatment aspect. So a lot of treatment can be provided to adults, but it's much harder for that to get tested and approved in kids. So there's a lot fewer options. So a lot of the money from Cassie and Friends goes to research, raising money for research for this treatment for children. Like, for example, in myself, I was on a medication all through my childhood where I got an injection once a week and it made me so nauseous, the side effects. Like, it handled my arthritis perfectly fine, but it just made me so nauseous. And when I switched to an adult rheumatologist in Kingston, I was telling her about this and I was like, is there anything we can do about the nausea? And I've been asking this forever. And my pediatric rheumatologists were always like, oh, you can try eating a sour candy. You can try watching a show, like things to distract yourself. But when I spoke to my adult rheumatologist, she said, well, why don't you try this pill? She was like, have you ever tried it before? And I was like, no, I've never been offered that. And she was like, oh, well, it's not approved in kids. It's only approved in adults. And this has changed my life completely because now I only do one injection a week because this one has switched to a pill and I get significantly less nauseous. So that's a perfect example of how there's so much more options, so many more options for adults, whereas in children, there's so many less. And this fundraising can provide funds for research for this treatment in children.
Ultimately, Cassie hopes the Kingston Run helps students and families connect.
So firstly, I hope that there's awareness raised around juvenile arthritis and other childhood rheumatic diseases in general, whether that's in the Queens community or the general Kingston community. And as well, I hope that people make friendships and bonds with each other. I hope that parents can meet each other and talk about what they went through, even if it's my dad's coming from Vancouver. So even if it's someone talking to my dad, even if it's not in the same city, just so they have people to talk to that have gone through a similar thing. The children as well, the siblings. I hope that everybody can form bonds and connections that can help them with their disease and diagnosis further on.
Cassie also noted that bringing the first Cassie and Friends Run to Kingston has been a true team effort, with support from both the national organization and students right here at Queens.
Yeah, I want to give a big shout out to all of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club exec. They've been great in finding sponsorships, planning the run, getting the cupcakes, everything like that. I've had a lot of help from them. I've had a lot of help from Marissa and Natalie at Cassie and Friends. And everyone has been very supportive and very helpful in planning this run. And I'm so excited to see how it turns out.
Once again, the first Team Cassie and Friends Kingston Run takes place March 7th from 9 to 11 a.m. at City Park. Registration and donations are available through the Cassie and Friends website. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this is Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstell, LJI reporter for the Kingstonist, about judicial decision-making related to the Napanee bylaw case over a Bridge Street property.
Thank you, Dinah. A Superior Court judge has reserved her decision after hearing arguments in the town of Greater Napanee's application to enforce municipal bylaws against a rural Bridge Street property that the town says is being used as an unpermitted residential trailer compound. Justin Robin Ryan Bell of the Ontario Superior Court of Justice heard submissions on Wednesday, March 4th, 2026, in the case Corporation of the Town of Greater Napanee, et al. Versus Bellinger, et al., an application brought under Section 440 of Ontario's Municipal Act. The town is seeking a court order or requiring the owner of the property, Jack Bellinger, to remove multiple trailers and other structures and bring the property into compliance with zoning and property standards bylaws. Due to the municipal involvement, the court's procedures, including last Wednesday's hearing, are taking place at the Frontenac County Courthouse, located at 5 Court Street in Kingston, rather than in neighboring Napanee. Bellinger and another respondent, Michael Godfrey, represented themselves during the hearing and did not file sworn affidavit evidence in response to the municipality's application. This, despite being given an extended period of time to do so at a hearing in January, with instructions given by Ryan Bell at that time. At the conclusion of the hearing, Justice Ryan Bell said, "I will be reserving my decision on this matter. I hope to have it out to the parties within the next couple of weeks." James McCarthy, counsel for the municipality, told the court that the property at 1388 Bridge Street is zoned prime agricultural, which allows only specific types of residential use. Those permitted uses include a single detached dwelling home, certain converted dwellings, group homes, special care facilities, transitional housing units, or home occupation slash industries. McCarthy argued that the current use of the property, which T described as multiple recreational trailers and makeshift structures occupied by residents, does not fall into any of those permitted categories. Zoning bylaws are admittedly a little weird, McCarthy told the court, because unlike most bylaws, under a zoning bylaw, every use of the land is illegal, except if an exception is made for a specific property. The town zoning bylaw, he explained, defines a dwelling house as a building used as a residence, but explicitly excludes trailers, motorhomes, or similar structures. So a trailer is clearly excluded from the definition of a dwelling house in the bylaw. A trailer does not count, he said. Because of that definition, McCarthy argued the trailers currently on the property cannot qualify as permitted residential uses under the zoning bylaw. The municipality is therefore seeking a statutory injunction under Section 440 of the Municipal Act to enforce compliance. The municipality is requesting the court's assistance in enforcing its bylaws, McCarthy said. The town's case relies primarily on an affidavit evidence filed by Deputy Fire Chief James Feeney, who attended the property in July 2025, in connection with a separate fire safety matter. According to McCarthy, Feeney observed between eight and ten trailers on the property, along with a crescent hut, that is a lightweight, prefabricated structure of corrugated galvanized steel that is semi-cylindrical in shape, sheds, propane tanks, and other materials. Drone photographs taken in May 2025 and included in the application record show trailers scattered across the rural property and connected by makeshift dirt roads. What we see in the photographs, McCarthy told the court, is effectively a compound, a makeshift neighborhood that has popped up here outside the supervision and regulation of the planning process. McCarthy said that the municipality has concerns about safety and sanitation at the site, pointing to photographs in the record showing garbage piled between trailers and muddy, rutted access roads. There are a number of photos where we can see that garbage is simply disposed behind the RV, close to the neighbors, he said. The town has also raised concerns about a lack of typical municipal services. We don't have information, unfortunately, on what's done with human waste and wastewater, McCarthy told the court. The municipality's position, he said, is that the zoning and building regulations exist as part of a broader system intended to ensure safe living conditions. This isn't simply the town being difficult and saying, follow the rules, McCarthy said. These rules fit into a puzzle that helps ensure adequate standards. The town is asking the court to declare the current use of the property unlawful under municipal bylaws and order the removal of trailers and other materials from the site. McCarthy said the municipality would allow time for compliance and suggested a deadline of May 1, 2026 for the property to be brought into conformity. We appreciate that it's going to take some time to do this, he said. The respondents, Bellinger and Godfrey, represented themselves during the hearing. Justice Ryan Bell repeatedly reminded the respondents that the court could only consider evidence properly filed in the application record. Because no responding affidavits had been submitted, the respondents were limited to responding to the municipality's submissions rather than introducing their new evidence. Bellinger told the court he had tried to help people who might otherwise have no other dwelling options. These people have nowhere to go, he said during the hearing, adding that forcing residents to leave the property could result in vulnerable individuals being pushed back onto the streets. Bellinger also indicated he was willing to work with the municipality to address its concerns. I will work with the town, he said. I will try and put it in order. He told the court he had never previously been involved in legal proceedings and was unfamiliar with the requirements of an application hearing. I've never done this before, he said. I don't know what you're saying, that I have to submit everything. During the hearing, Godfrey attempted to bring a motion asking the court to strike Feeney's affidavit from the record. Godfrey argued he had not been given the opportunity to cross-examine the deputy fire chief, saying, I didn't receive an invitation to see his testimony. Justice Ryan Bell rejected the motion. She noted that a timetable set earlier in the proceedings had provided an opportunity to conduct cross-examinations on Tuesday, February 17, 2026, and that he had been the respondent's responsibility to request such an examination. Godfrey said he did not believe he needed to give advance notice, but the judge told him a second time, in fact, you do need to. She ruled the motion was improper and confirmed that Feeney's affidavit would remain part of the record. The property at 1388 Bridge Street has been under scrutiny by the town of Greater Napanee for at least 2 years due to safety and bylaw concerns. In July 2025, town officials attended the property with assistance from the Ontario Provincial Police, Public Works staff, and the fire department, serving court documents and seizing several wood-burning stoves that were considered unsafe. Municipal officials have said the property contains makeshift dwellings and structures that pose fire hazards and other risks. The town says it has begun trying to achieve voluntary compliance in 2024 through education and negotiation with the property owner, but was unsuccessful. As a result, the municipality applied to the Superior Court for an order compelling compliance with zoning and property standards bylaws. Court documents identify the applicants as the corporation of the town of Greater Napanee and the town's chief building official. Bellinger is listed as the primary respondent, along with unidentified occupants described in the application as John Doe and Jane Doe. The application first came before the court on January 22, 2026, when Justice Ryan Bell adjourned the matter after determining that the self-represented respondents had not filed admissible evidence. At that hearing, the judge explained that the proceeding was not a trial, but rather that it was an application, meaning evidence must be presented through sworn affidavits rather than oral testimony. She granted additional time for affidavit material to be filed and set a timetable for cross-examinations and written submissions before the matter returned to court in March. Despite that timetable, no responding affidavit evidence was filed before Wednesday's hearing. The judge's ruling, expected in the next couple of weeks, will determine whether the court grants the town's request for an injunction requiring the property to be brought into compliance with municipal bylaws. If the order is granted, the court could require the removal of trailers and other structures from the site and prohibit further residential occupation in recreational vehicles or similar structures unless they comply with zoning and building.
Thank you, Henry, and to Michelle Dory Forstell of the Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LJI reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, about the town's participation in the Coldest Night of the Year movement.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
There was an exciting buzz in the main hall of the Picton Community Center on Saturday as nearly 200 people came together to participate in the Coldest Night of the Year fundraising walk. It is the first time Prince Edward County residents have participated in the nationwide annual fundraiser that supports local charities helping people who are experiencing hurt, hunger, and homelessness. The early evening was cold but sunny for the walkers to stroll the 2 or 5 kilometer route around historic Picton. And the hope was to raise $30,000 for the Picton United Church Food Bank, but thanks to the generosity of the community, they expect to raise over $65,000. Mark Houghton is a volunteer at the food bank and spearheaded the idea to take part in the Coldest Night of the Year fundraising event. Mark tells us more.
Yeah, we're the first-time crew, and of the first-time walking groups, we are number one across Canada. We raised $63,000 for the Picton United Church Food Bank. We had 135-plus walkers. We had 35 volunteers, and they had over 640 donors amongst them. Wonderful. Unfortunately, we're 40% up year over year in terms of volume for our food bank. They're all new clients. They're folks that that need a little bit of help.
And are they all from Picton or from the area?
We serve Picton, basically half the county. The other half serviced by Wellington.
Tara Wood rounded up a team of her friends called the County Huggers, and they were the top fundraisers, bringing in $14,000. Tara tells me more.
And Tara, you have a huge group that made a whole bunch of money. What do you call yourself?
We're the County Huggers.
And how did you make all this money?
You know, we are a group that moved here about 5 years ago. We all kind of moved from different places, and we love our community. Personally, myself, I got interested in the food insecurity mandate out here. I had no idea the stats of how many people in our community were going without food, so I got involved with the Wellington Food Bank and the PEC Food Collective. It's an issue that's become very close to my heart. I got a bunch of my friends involved, and it's been super fun having a competition to just raise funds and do really good.
So your group, are you entrepreneurs or what?
I think most of us are entrepreneurs. Most of us are small business owners out here, but I think, you know, we just share a passion for community, right?
Yes.
We just love the people where we live.
Yes. It's amazing that people from away come here and grasp on to the needs.
Yep.
So quickly.
100%. And I mean, we are lucky that I have never struggled. We know that we have privilege, and we want to make sure we are doing good for others, because it's so important that we give back and everyone continue to play a role and raise awareness, whether that's donating, giving their time, giving money, getting involved, you know, volunteering doesn't need to be a weekly commitment. It can just be as you need it. There's so many ways to get involved and so many great organizations that you can give your time to.
I understand you guys have raised $13,000, if I'm not mistaken.
We're like $60 short of $14,000, so
Oh, wow.
We will get there.
I caught up with a few walkers to see how they enjoyed their evening stroll, and they seemed invigorated.
How was the walk, folks?
The walk was invigorating.
Oh, good.
It was great. The wind was keeping us energized. The roads were dry. And, yeah, feel great.
And we got these great hats.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And it's a good cause.
It yes. is. It's a great cause. And yeah.
Meeting community members, seeing everybody out together is very inspiring.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Coming up, CFRC's Juliana Gonsalves is reading a story by Michelle Dory Forestell of the Kingstonist on March break activities at the Museum of Lennox in Addington.
Thank you, Dinah. For parents wondering how to entertain their school-age children during March break, the Museum of Lennox in Addington has the answer. This year, the museum is hosting several events as part of its March Break Create programming. Kids and families are invited to dive into hands-on experiences that spark creativity through art, music, storytelling, movement, and more. From historical discoveries through animated storytelling to experiences that will make children build big and think creatively, the museum's March Break programming promises to thrill and delight. The schedule's programming includes Create Stories, the Big History Mystery, with the Paddling Puppeteers on March 16th at 11 a.m., the Create Music, Sing and Dance with Kingston Frontenac Music Together on March 17th at 11 a.m., the Create Art Nature Art Workshop on March 18th at 11 a.m., Yoga Poses with Pups on March 19th at 2 p.m., the Create Connections Make Your Own Clay Magnet events on March 20th at 10:30 a.m. and again at 2:30 p.m. And finally, the Create Structures Build Quest drop-in event starting at 10:30 on March 21st. Aside from the event on March 20th, all events are $5 with free admission for those under 5. For more information, please visit countrymuseum.ca.
Thank you so much, Juliana. Coming up next, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. Tuesday night, we're expecting cloudy skies with a 60% chance of showers and a low plus 3. On Wednesday, showers with a high plus 6. Wednesday night, periods of snow or rain, low minus 2. On Thursday, cloudy with a 40% chance of flurries, windy and a high of 0. Thursday night, cloudy skies with a low minus 6. And on Friday, we'll see periods of snow, high plus 1, and cloudy with a 40% chance of snow on Friday night with a low minus 8. And now back to Juliana Gonsalves with this week's concert and events calendar.
Hello, hello, and happy Leprechaun Week. It's your girl Gigi, CFRC's newest intern, and you're listening to What's Live at 5 on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up on this segment, I've got Cape Town's hottest concert and event calendars for the week. Tuesday, March 10th marks my favorite, Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam with Tom Savage at the club at the RCHA at 4 p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. The dance school will also be performing their production of George Orwell's Animal Farm at Theological Hall Rotunda Theater at 7:30 p.m. to 10 o'clock p.m. Be sure to come out and support. On Wednesday, March 11th, Why Not Theatre presents What You Won't Do for Love, a hybrid live theatre and film performance starring renowned environmentalists Drs. David Suzuki and Tara Cullis, reflecting on their 50-year relationship, their shared adventures, and their advocacy for the planet. This charming and conversational show asks, can we learn to love the planet as much as we love other people? Find them at the Kingston Grand Theatre Rosen Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. The Wonderful Women Community Choir will be meeting at Crossroads United Church at 1 p.m. until 3 o'clock p.m. Don't forget to bring your wonderful voices.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.